The Fearless Podcast, in a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. All right, y'all, welcome back to the Fearless Podcast. This is episode 35. And once again, I have an exciting author on tonight, and I'm really have been looking forward to this interview. And I want to introduce y'all to A.W. Finnegan. Hey, Adam, how you doing this evening?
Hey, it's good to be on. Thank you for having me on. We'll have a great discussion tonight.
So I guess tell us the title of your book, and then we can kind of get into it.
So the title of the book is The Sleeper Agent, The Rise of Lyme Disease, Chronic Illness, and the Great Imitator Antigens of Biological Warfare. And so sleeper agent is kind of got like a double meaning, because sleeper agent, Eric Traub was a double agent for the KGB. And so he was kind of like sent over here for Stalin. And it's also like the Lyme disease, this antigen kind of puts your immune system to sleep. And it's almost, it lays dormant for a while and then activates later, kind of like a sleeper agent being activated. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, cool. So how about we start? What got you even interested in Lyme disease? Maybe explain that whole origin story.
Well, I got Lyme disease. My mother had it when I was younger. And then later I found out I had it. And I may have had it all along, because some of these things just take a while to get rolling. Sometimes you can be born with it and then much later really activates, or if you get like another dose of it from another tick. And I was bitten by a tick that year that I got sick. And so I got these really crazy headaches, all this sinus pressure. The headaches are still there, they don't go away. But I went in to try to get like help for my health problems, and it was like they just kept sending me to all these different specialists. None of them can figure out anything wrong with me. Eventually, they just said, oh, we can't find anything wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with you. I was like, okay. It's normal to have constant headaches then, you know, and like the scans wouldn't show anything. And it goes to the heart of what's in this book, a phenomenon called immune tolerance. And that is a big thing in this book. It's something that was discovered by Eric Traub, and it serves as the basis of his stealth weapons. They're like, basically, you can think of immune tolerance as chronic immunosuppression. So it's like this. And what happens is, when you get these kinds of chronic diseases, there's very little inflammation involved, even though you can feel, you know, all of this pain and all that. But they take scans and they don't see anything. And that's because of the immunosuppression. It's not producing that inflamed enough for them to see it like an acute disease. So it really goes to the heart of what's in this book. And that is that immune tolerance phenomenon that his weapons produce, but also Lyme disease produces that too. And also, of course, it can be induced through shots as well.
What I found was fascinating is basically the depth of your research and getting all of this Eric Traub's work and then translating it and then compiling it. How long did this take you?
I was working on this book for about 6 years.
Wow.
And there was a period of heavy, heavy work just every day. Like I got the list of all of the citations for all of the papers that he had produced. I got everything. And I had to go through this distributor, Eureka Mag, and they would go to the German, they had access to the German universities where these papers were kept, because a lot of these papers were only available in Germany. So these distributors, they sell medical papers online. You can go to them, and I started working with them, and I had to buy a lot of that stuff. And fortunately, I also had some help with some, because I was acting as a consultant slash advisor to some filmmakers who are kind of doing a project on the same thing. And my book, like as I was writing my book, I was advising them on the story. And then they would also help me out by helping me get a lot of these important papers. And so I basically got like, I got all these three ring binders over there, and you can see, right. So
yeah,
that's like all of the work there of, I basically would translate them by running them through like Google Translate, getting them into text, getting the entire text, because it was the fastest way to do it. You know what I mean? And then I would kind of go through and fix up whatever stuff didn't look right. And it was just the fastest way to do it. And that's what I did. And there was a lot of work. And I also translated a lot of his colleagues from Germany as well, from this facility that he worked at called Insel Reims. And Insel Reims was like the Plum Island of Germany. And Plum Island was actually set up based on that facility, because Eric Traub was advising them how it was set up when he was brought over here. He was basically put as like the head guy running biological warfare, a supervisory bacteriologist. But after I started getting sick and realized I could not get any help, that's what got me started looking into this stuff. And I remember I had read Lab 257 many years before that, and I always just felt Traub was a very mysterious character, and I was drawn to him and his work. And I was like, there's something about this guy. I think he's definitely the guy involved here. And I started looking into him. I started collecting all of his work. And then I realized that he's the one who discovered this immune tolerance thing. Cause I had learned about immune tolerance from these Lyme disease activists at Truth Cures. Someone named Kathleen Dixon, and of course her friend Laura Hoven. And some of the other ones, they taught me about this immune tolerance thing. It was hard to understand at first, but basically it's like your immune system is suppressed. And when your immune system gets so suppressed by these things, then all of these viruses that are latent in your body start reactivating and start destroying or just causing this slow chronic disease. And the thing is that the medical system, they don't acknowledge these kinds of diseases. So there's people with like chronic fatigue, myalgic encephalitis, and all of that. They get labeled as somatoform, that they're imagining their disease, things like that, but they're not. It's that there's this whole other spectrum of disease, chronic disease, that is marked by immunosuppression. And they don't accept that because they basically look at it like, inflammation is the cause of all disease, but actually there's a whole other spectrum that of disease that happens in the absence of inflammation.
And the beauty of that as a bioweapon is like not traceable. You don't even know it's there, basically.
Yeah, it's concept behind his stealth weapon. So he found this way to reactivate. He started an epidemic from scratch. Basically, so he took foreign proteins and injected into a mouse's brain. It caused like this immunosuppressive shock, and then this latent virus that were in the mice reactivated and caused an epidemic in the mouse colony, and it actually infected a few of the workers too. It was called lymphocytic chorioamnionitis virus, or LCM virus, and that's a big thing in this book too. And so he discovered that immune tolerance thing, and that was his kind of his blueprint for these stealth weapons, because he wasn't doing this to try to help humanity. He was in this to make weapons. And he was like, Eric Traub was, he was a very, very intelligent guy, but he was not a very moral guy.
Right.
And I mean, this guy was on a whole different level than a lot of the other virologists of this time. Like, he was,
who was he developing these weapons for?
He worked for three superpowers. He worked for Germany, the Reich. Then he worked for the Soviet Union. And then he came over here to work for us. So he had also worked for us in the 30s at the Rockefeller Institute. Then we brought him over here. So he's working here again.
Did he come over with a paperclip?
Huh?
Did he come over
with a paperclip? Yes. Yeah. He brought over a paperclip. But when we brought him over here, so it seemed, and what I have in the story is it seemed that, so it looks like they were doing some experiments on insulines with some of the forced labor. And the Soviet Union captured East Germany, and insulines was in East Germany. So the Russians captured that. They took it. So Stalin put insulines under his personal protection. It was a very important institute. And it seems that they were looking for war crimes so that they could blackmail these people into working for the Soviet Union. And basically, like, okay, you can go to Nuremberg or you can work for us. What'll it be? And so it seems that he was flipped to the KGB, and then he was sent over here to attack us, basically. And he was just attacking us right under our noses. We were just so stupid. And then one thing I want to say is, like, so this whole communist infiltrations thing, I start from like World War I in this book, but on another note, this whole, the Stalin and all these communists, they have been infiltrating us for a long time. And I think they are kind of like what became eventually this globalism cabal thing, you know, like a lot of these and, you know, like a lot of those big Wall Street guys were instrumental in setting up the Soviet Union. So there was always like this, you know. So when I talk about Russia, I'm talking about it, like these communists, especially in Stalin's day, these guys were terrible. I know, like, because nowadays, you know, when you say Russia, people just kind of like, you know, they think, oh, yeah, Russian hysteria. That's not really what I'm talking about. You got to kind of understand the story from like the very beginning and see, you'd see that this is kind of like the same group that worked with a lot of this, what became globalism.
Right. And that's why, you know, we've defeated the Russians and we've defeated the communists and the Soviets. Right. But basically, our infrastructure here, relatively speaking, is completely communist. You know, all this postmodernism in America.
That's what I mean. So there were, and especially in the medical and public health realms, it's, and we took a lot of their scientists over here, and now they fill public health. Like, for example, one of Stalin's top bioweaponeers, MP Chumakov, this guy was a hardcore bioweaponeer, tested weapons on, you know, possibly killing off millions of Muslims and Mongolians in Siberia. Well, his son is running vaccine safety at the FDA right now, Konstantin Chumakov. And so he got his foot in the door with Sabin. And MP Chumakov, I have a whole chapter on him in the end, and I talk about it in chapter 4. He worked, we allowed him to team up with Albert Sabin to produce the oral polio vaccine. And he also worked somewhat with Salk. So this guy was like the most hardcore Stalinist bioweaponeer, but we let him work on these vaccines that would be given to millions of Americans. And of course, it was contaminated by SV40.
And that's why this information is so critical and important, because it dispels this whole, you know, no one denies that there's not power brokers and power moves between Russia, China, and the U.S. and what have you. But behind the scenes, they're all working together, or they're all sabotaging each other.
And a lot of people, I mean, there's like a lot of people who think Putin is this great guy, but he grew up in the KGB. He idolized Stalin. He still idolizes Stalin. His grandfather was Stalin's food taster, a chef. So this guy is like brainchild of Stalin. He looked up to Stalin. He wants that kind of stuff. Like, people don't understand that. I know, because there's just been a lot of disinformation. And then, you know, there was some of this Russian hysteria stuff. Yeah. But that, you know, he's definitely, and he, when he worked in Section K of the KGB, he signed off on a lot of bioterrorism against the United States. So people don't realize how much of a criminal that guy is.
And it's really no different than the Anglo-American establishment and all the extent that the U.S. went to establish China as a superpower, to build it up as such, you know, and then to create it like it's this boogeyman China, China, China thing. When we set it up, we established it. It's very similar to this whole Israel Gaza thing and this Hamas thing and all that stuff. It's always, you know, the method is always the same. It's the same model. It's the same method. The names and the addresses change, but relatively speaking, it's the same model.
Yeah, and, it was interesting how the British were also heavily involved in setting up the Soviet Union too. So.
So you're saying that Eric Traub, he was a double agent, and what he was doing here was clandestinely sabotaging and poisoning us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So was he directly involved with Plum Island?
What's that?
Was Traub directly involved in Plum Island?
Yeah. Yeah. And I have him linked to it through this law that they passed. I forget what it was called. But He had put down too on things that he worked at Plum Island, and I have the congressional hearing where they're looking at where they want to set up Plum Island, and they were talking. They made a reference to Traub, and it was understood that he would be working there when he came over here. But he also worked in Maryland, Bethesda, Maryland, at the NMRI, the Naval Medical Research Institute. He was working for the Navy, he was working for the USDA, and he was also doing work for other military. And it was, I mean, he was put up very, very high up. Like, he was basically overseeing our biological warfare program. And he was a KGB agent. And the thing about, so he's a veterinarian, but veterinarians were always the best bioweaponeers.
That, you know who else was a veterinarian? Albert Bourla.
He's
the head of Pfizer.
I know who he is. Yeah. Okay.
Sounds like Count Dracula.
They were always the best bioweaponeers, because like Eric Traub made a fine art of turning animal diseases into human pathogens. So this adaptation thing, right? And another thing is, before the advent of modern day genetic engineering, what they did, how they made things, how they manipulated these things, is through what were called animal passages. So they would find animals, infect them, let the disease run out, isolate it, but then they would run it through like another animal, and they found like whatever they could find certain animals brought certain mutations and characteristics, right? So, for example, mouse passages, running it through mice over and over, increased the neurotropic qualities. That means like its tendency to destroy the brain and central nervous system. And so they found things like, okay, running it through chickens could increase the cardiotropic quality. So it would take to the heart more, stuff like that. And so Eric Traub had made a fine art of it, and he would adapt things to new animals it didn't infect. And that was the whole thing about you know, bringing animal diseases to infect humans. And he often did this with chicken eggs. And so he would run it through a mouse, and he'd run it through a chicken egg, then he'd run it through a mouse, then a chicken egg. He had a very, his methodology was very reliable. And that's the way they did this before the advent of genetic engineering. And even today, genetic engineering technology would not be preferred, because these animal passages make it so that it looks like, so that it's untraceable. Right. There's no evidence of tampering, because you're running it through these animals, even though you're mutating it the same way, but without leaving any footprints of genetic engineering technology. That's why even today, if they're making bioweapons, they'll do it with animals. And it's funny, because, you know, this whole talk about, you know, SARS coronavirus 2 come from a lab? They're like, no, we think it came from animals. But when they're running it through animals in a lab, like in gain of function research, they do ferrets. So that's an animal. So it kind of makes the whole discussion erroneous when you say, oh, well, it came from animals, so it must be from the wild.
Yeah, tomato, tomato. It's the same thing.
And so that's what made Eric Traub. He studied at the Rockefeller Institute, but then he also studied with some really, really good virologists and bacteriologists in Germany. His mentor was, his name was Carl Beller. And he learned from a bunch of other people. He had skill when it came to this virus research and bacteriology. He understood it better than most. He just had a lot of talent in this, but it was, you know, used for weapons instead of doing good.
Mm-hmm. So we've mentioned Plum Island. So maybe for many people that don't know, maybe you could explain what we're talking about with Plum Island and why it's significant.
Okay, so Plum Island, that's the animal disease. That's what the USDA runs Plum Island right now. They work with animal diseases, you know, like foot and mouth disease virus. That was a big virus that Eric Traub worked with too over in Germany. But Plum Island is kind of like the epicenter of where Lyme disease shows up in America first. And what they were doing, Eric Traub. So John Loftus is the one who wrote the introduction to my book. Yeah. And he was the one to initially bring out this information that Lyme disease may have been a biological weapon. And it was in his 1982 book, The Belarus Secret, which is now called America's Nazi Secret. And he said that Plum Island, in that he said that these experiments were taking place with ticks on Plum Island. And he said Lyme disease was being spread by ticks before they had even acknowledged that it was. And then the next year they acknowledged that it was being spread by ticks. But then they were saying, no, these experiments never took place. And what they were doing is they were releasing these ticks on shorebirds, Eric Traub, and then they would track how these things spread out. And they were supposed to be infected with harmless tracers, right? These harmless what I mean is simulants. They were called simulants. So it would be a simulation of a real biological weapon. They were supposed to be harmless.
It was like a tabletop exercise.
Yeah. And so, right. But what they didn't know is that these were weaponized with all of these nasty diseases. And he basically was carrying out bioterrorism, stealth bioterrorism, overlapping this whole simulant program. The simulant program was taking place nationwide. They would spray bacteria all over the place to see how it spreads out, even though people died and were hospitalized from it. And they were doing this nationwide, but they were also doing these simulant tests with insects, seeing how insects could spread out. And so, it's really just really ridiculous. But it's what they did. And they're still doing this today, probably even more so. But he attacked us many times over, and it wasn't just with these, but Plum Island is kind of like the epicenter, and Eric Traub advised them on setting it up. So he was like they call Eric Trapp the godfather of Plum Island.
Wow.
Right. And so this was kind of modeled after the same facility that he ran in Germany. And so John Loftus, he was the one to bring that out initially. And he wrote the introduction to my book, which is awesome. And, you know, he talks about how his sources in government who held Q level clearances like him, it's like the highest clearance you can get, were saying that, yeah, there were these bioterrorism attacks on us that were unleashed on Americans. And they wanted to come forward, but they didn't want the reprisals. They didn't want the wrath that John Loftus got for exposing Paperclip. But he was like, so over the years, he was kind of working as a pro bono attorney, taking, you know, testimony from what they had to say. And he was trying to find ways that he could get it declassified. And so I had made this timeline a long time ago about biological weapons, and I had sent it to him. I found John Loftus on like Facebook, and I sent it to him back when I was on social media. I'm not anymore, but he got back to me, and he's like, oh, this is wonderful, wonderful. And so we started talking because I was looking into Lyme disease at that time. It was around 2017. And he started, you know, I was like, hey, I'm gonna write a book about this. I think I'm going to write a book about this. You know, maybe you could help me, tell me what you know. You know, and he started giving me, he started telling me a lot of like awesome hints. Like he'd be like, look in this direction, look in this direction. And I would. And I just found so much. I mean, I was able to put this story together in such a cohesive way. And he had given me so much good intelligence, and it was invaluable. And I was like, hey, can you write the introduction? And he said he would. And I was so happy because, I mean, that's a big deal to have him backing this up. He was the one who originally brought it out, you know? And now, so
two of the things that I find fascinating, maybe you could discuss a little bit about why they chose ticks as a carrier.
So ticks, yeah, the ticks are really there. It's really hard to get rid of ticks. And they basically, he made these diseases so that they would be transmitted to the young, but he also made these diseases that were very broad spectrum pathogenicity. So again, it could infect a very large different number of animals, humans, and so that it could kind of create like the snowball effect in the environment, where it's just this agent is thriving exponentially each, you know, decade. And that's what we're seeing with these tick-borne diseases. And these ticks, they're so hard to get rid of, and they're just like a menace. I mean, I know up here in Cape Cod, it's terrible some years. And I remember the year I got bit, it was horrible that year. You couldn't even, it's like you couldn't even go out in the yard without getting them on you.
And then secondly, didn't he also aerosolize the disease or something? He made it airborne.
Yeah. And that was a very interesting thing, because he was making some of these tick-borne diseases airborne, like the rickettsia, for instance. Like, so typhus is a rickettsia. It's a form of these insect-borne diseases. And a lot of them, like Rocky Mountain fever, for example, is one of them. But he was making them airborne. And it was said in his file that there were no scientists with the level of skill that he and his technical assistant, Ann Berger, had, even though it doesn't look like Ann Berger ever made it over here. But Eric Traub, what it said in his file was that there was nobody like him. There's nobody who can replace him. And that kind of brings up the whole idea about, you know, people have blamed Willie Bergdorfer for Lyme disease, but I find that to be erroneous. And Willie Bergdorfer accidentally infected himself in the laboratory when he was dealing with this stuff, because I don't think he realized how infectious it was, because Eric Traub had made them so much more infectious. He may have even made that thing airborne at one point.
We've always held the idea, you know, they're spraying a bunch of stuff up in the air, and it's so interesting how regionally everyone gets sick at the same time with like whatever. And we've always thought, like, man, I wonder if they're just spraying this stuff on us.
Well, this brings up another interesting point, is that so these simulant tests, a lot of what they did was they sprayed these things from planes, okay? And they kept doing it. They're still doing it today, and it seems like they're not just spraying it because they want to know how it spreads out. Because, I mean, think about it. It's like, don't you know how it spreads out already after 40 years?
I mean, whatever.
But I think what it is this aerogenic vaccine program. That's what I'm thinking. That's what the evidence, because in chapter 11 of my book, I talk about how they had cleared vaccinia virus as a standard simulant. So they were spraying that all over the place. That's the smallpox vaccine.
And that was in the 40s, right? Was that in the 40s?
What's that?
Oh, yeah. What, the 40s?
No, this was the 50s.
50s, okay.
In the 50s, they were spraying vaccinia virus all over the place like a standard simulant. And then I have a document from 1993 where they were looking at the different vaccines they could use as standard simulants. And they were talking about how the vaccinia virus that they had cleared for the simulants was actually a virus of high pathogenicity with a long and sporadic history of fatal infections and post-vaccinial encephalitis, which is swelling of the brain.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's like this whole idea, we got to protect you from biological agents, but then they spray all this stuff on us, and that is like just as bad as the weapon.
Yeah, exactly. Problem, reaction, solution.
Yeah. And so it seems to me like they have this aerogenic vaccine program, which is infuriating to think that they're doing that. But I'm thinking, and this may be kind of interwoven into this whole geoengineering chemtrails thing.
Mm-hmm,
because, sure. You know, my mother, for example, knows somebody from Harvard who's saying, yeah, they're doing it. Yeah, they are doing it.
Wow.
And I've known this for a long time, but I'm thinking that they may have an aerogenic vaccine program that's kind of done in the same way.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're going around spraying like flu vaccine or what, but. And they were, you know, they were trying to put the vaccinia virus. There was a paper where they were growing the vaccinia virus in these simulant bacteria, which is strange. But so it's really crazy, the whole simulant thing. But it was during those years that there was like this. I talk about a Day X, which is like this large scale bioterrorism against the West by Stalin. And it seems like that was initiated when they brought Eric Traub over here.
Hmm.
And so John Loftus had a friend that he knew, a guy that he knew, an intelligence guy who actually interrogated Traub and got him to confess to being a Soviet double agent. And that's a really interesting part of my book where I talk about that. And that's how we know. And so, yeah, and his name was Dan Benjamin. He was from the CIC, Counterintelligence Corps. And I included a long passage by John Loftus talking about where he tells the story of Traub's interrogation and such. But I can lay out with reliable scientific evidence how this Lyme disease and these co-infections can be linked to Eric Traub. I show when he got the spirochete. He got it in 1939 over in Germany. He started weaponizing it over in Germany because that's why it also shows up in Germany first. So, and then when the Soviet Union captured Insel Reims, his facility, they brought strains to the Soviet Union. Then he brought strains over to America. And I think, so there was this guy, Donald McLean. He was one of the Cambridge Five spies. He was the guy who was responsible for getting Eric Traub over here. And that guy ended up defecting to the Soviet Union in 1951. And that's kind of like what set off Traub's interrogation, was that, you know, this guy who's a Soviet double agent got Traub over here. And a lot of these other Nazis were also working for the KGB. It was just like he brought strains over here, and I can show like the path it follows everywhere Traub goes. And he was also taking trips down to Colombia, Bogota. He was back and forth between Bogota and the Eastern United States.
And what was going on in Bogota?
So he set up a foot and mouth disease lab, but Lyme disease also shows up down there. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like he basically spread the thing worldwide, and they were spreading it on birds. They had this whole bird program where they could say, okay, attaching ticks to birds and then send them out as the weapon, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's really stupid to think that, I don't know. I mean, it's just, it's complete insanity, but that's what they were doing. And I show, it was a bird strain of this Borrelia spirochete called Borrelia anserina. Back then it was called Spirochaeta gallinarum, but it's Borrelia anserina. And so he started weaponizing that, adapting it to different animals, made it very, and he was using these viral proteins to make it just really nasty. And it started, you know, it could take to pretty much anything. It's spread by birds. It can infect cattle. And so,
And these guys are so evil. Like I guess they never consider the fact that like I could spread this junk everywhere so thoroughly that I could end up getting it. Like they don't even, it's weird that they don't even have any semblance of self-preservation to say, maybe this is a really bad idea.
Yeah. So that's brings up an important thing about biological warfare. It's like, because people are like, I don't get it. I don't understand it. Don't they realize they could get infected too? It's like, and they actually do a lot of times. Mm-hmm. It's like, but it brings back to the senselessness of things like war, things we do for war, you know, like, I mean, making these massive nuclear weapons, it's like the most complete insanity you can think of. But it's kind of the same idea, but biological warfare became the go-to. And why people don't know this is because most of it is classified. Like this is an area that is so heavily classified that you're not going to hear much about it.
And there's crossover with like the USDA. I mean, what in the world does the USDA have to, they're supposed to be keeping diseases out of our food. They're not supposed to be experimenting with disease.
So here's the thing too, is that biological warfare is always done under the cover of benign research. That's how every country runs their program. So the USDA will have bioweapons programs or the people in it. And you know, there a lot of them were like military guys too. But that's what they do, the whole name of the game, because biological weapons are seen as a very immoral, you know, they're seen with disdain by the global community. And so each country tries to hide it as best as they can. And they always hide it under things like animal disease and especially animal disease, like agriculture, made the best cover for these, because people are just like, oh, they're just working with animal disease. Right. You know? Exactly. But Eric Traub was taking these animal diseases and adapting them to humans. And so
So Adam, you got Lyme disease. And so how have you, so through studying all this and the background, how have you managed your Lyme disease? What do you do to manage your Lyme disease?
Well, in the beginning, I was just trying to treat it with so many different ways, and it just always felt like it just made me sicker. I haven't really been treating it at all. I just been kind of eating right, getting out every day. It seems like it's starting to taper off. I'm doing a lot better now, but there was a period where it was just like some days I was just so sick. I could not even get out of bed and just felt like I was dying. But that's usually what happens is you get sick for like a number of years, like really sick. And then it starts to taper off some. Like I still have the headaches and stuff, but I just kind of manage the thing.
With diet.
Yeah.
And exercise.
Yeah. Stuff like that. Cause I just haven't found much use. And, you know, I've known a lot of girls who got themselves a lot sicker by taking massive doses of antibiotics.
Sure.
And so it just, you know, I saw what some of these other people were saying. I was like, yeah, I'm not going to go that route, you know?
Yeah. Have you tried anything like a carnivore diet or anything like that?
Yeah, I've done a lot of different stuff. And, you know, I'm at the point now where I think like I'm a lot less sick than I used to be.
Great.
I'm a vegetarian now.
Okay. But,
like I've been a vegetarian for like a year and a half. And, you know, another like first off, it's a moral thing for me, but, you know, people might not understand that, but that's all right. And but it's also, you know, after all of the stuff that I see in these animal disease realms, it's like almost like I don't even want to eat meat now. And all the stuff that they're doing, you know, with the shots that they give these animals and all that stuff. And I actually started feeling a little better without it. But I eat well and I get good exercise. I like BMX biking. So I do that every day. I just kind of live a balanced life. But, you know, a lot like back when I was learning from that group Truth Cures, like they were always saying it's incurable. And it may actually be that way, or at least I don't know. It doesn't seems like people may get rid of it for a time, but it seems like it just goes into cyst form, which because when you it can go into cyst form and go latent. But then it seems that much later, it comes back.
Gotcha.
It comes back and comes back online. And, you know, Kathleen Dixon might have been right when she said it's incurable. But, I mean, I've been able to manage pretty well lately. I haven't had those days where I'm, like, incredibly sick. So, it's been good. But this... I actually wrote this book, even when I was like really sick, I was just driven to do it. And I, you know, some days I'd be like, oh man, I'd be on the computer like 12 hours a day. My eyes feel like they're bulging out of their sockets from looking at the screen all day, you know, on like PubMed and all these different places. And I, especially doing all those translations too.
Wow. That's so crazy.
I was able to like put reliable evidence that shows. Yeah. So in 1946, the black-legged tick, the tick that spreads Lyme disease, was not a known transmitter of any human diseases. Right. And then the USDA started doing all these experiments. And then in 1956, they're saying the black-legged tick is now carrying all these diseases.
Wow.
And another interesting point is that Lyme disease did not start in 1975. It was spreading since the 50s. But they didn't acknowledge it until 1975 through this cluster of cases of kids with arthritis. So a lot of people are like, what happened in 1975? Well, actually nothing. They just acknowledged it in 1975. But there's a woman named Polly Murray who wrote a book called The Widening Circle. And in it, she tells her story of Lyme disease. And she got sick in the summer of 1955, I think it was.
Wow.
So that shows that, yeah, it was this incident with Traub. And we sent him back to Germany after he confessed to being a Soviet double agent. He should have been put to death for that.
Yeah.
Like, well, I mean, normally people would get a death sentence for that.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was he was working for the FAO, which is the Food and Agriculture Organization. It's like the World Health Organization. Mm-hmm. It's a UN organization, but he had diplomatic immunity when he was sent over here. So,
yeah.
And the Eisenhower administration. So Eric Traub had designed the bug bombs that we dropped on North Korea. I don't know if you know about that. North Korea, during the Korean War, mm-hmm. we unleashed bioweapons on North Korea with the British and the UN.
Of course.
And Eric Traub had been the one who designed all of that. And so he had all of that dirt on them. And so, you know, so it seemed that Stalin had blackmailed a bunch of people from the Eisenhower administration into silence, according to John Loftus. And then they're like, okay. Oh, so Traub was kind of like, well, I'm just an unimportant little guy. And this, he made up this big excuse saying because the reason they interrogated him was because he kept turning down these top positions for like the USCA, because it would include a really intense background check.
Right.
And he didn't want that. So they were like, why does he keep declining these offers? And eventually it initiated. And then, you know, that whole thing with Donald McLean had defected was also bringing attention into him. So eventually he gets interrogated and he's like, so it was funny. The guy went through his story and he said something like, do you have anything to say before you're shipped off to be tried as a war criminal or Soviet spy? And he really wasn't going to be, but it was like a tactic. And then he broke down and confessed. He's like, yes, okay, I am a Soviet double agent, you know. So he kind of tricked him and he got him. And then he's like, but I'm such an unimportant. I turned down those top positions because I was trying to stay low so they wouldn't bother with a little guy like me, even though he wasn't a little guy. He was like the top bioweaponeer he was like the VIP of the world, as in the bioweapons game. So, but the Eisenhower administration, because of all of that stuff he was involved in, they're like, well, we'll just accept his explanation and we'll fire him from this country and we'll deport him back to Germany. And that's what they did, even though he continued to hold a position with the FAO at the UN.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. And then he went, so they sent him back to Germany to run a lab in West Germany. And there was this big embezzlement investigation of him after he had been running that for a number of years. And his vice president, you know, was sexually assaulting people. And it was like a animal house of a bioweapons lab. You know that movie Animal House? It's like, well, because I have some like passages about him like being out with his vice president and they're going to like strip clubs and just party, being party animals. And
yeah, thought they were bulletproof, you know,
because they were brazen and running the place. And so they got this big investigation. Traub actually got charges brought against him. He avoided doing jail time with a fine. But I had gotten that big embezzlement investigation, went through it all. I mean, it's pretty crazy. But then after that, he goes to Iran for the FAO.
Wow.
Oh, and here's another thing. He was also taking trips back to the U.S., like for different events, even after he was, you know, named.
Yeah.
So it was really crazy because, you know, you'd think someone like that normally would get a death sentence. And this guy's just continuing all his research. People are sending him
on a no fly list, right? At least he's
sending him viruses from the US. You know, it's like he's running a bioweapons lab over there. And it's just crazy. So then he went to Iran But then he came back and eventually died in 1985. And I kind of go through his whole story, and this whole immune tolerance thing is very important because it also ties in to why what the vaccines and shots are doing to people. Yeah. Is inducing this same state of immune tolerance, chronic disease.
Yeah.
Basically, it's burning out the immune system. And so, you know, whether you get rid of acute diseases, you replace them with these slow chronic ones that are much more resistant and don't resolve very easily.
Right. And why I think it's really important to talk about is, you know, in the last, since 2020 and all this talk of biological warfare, you know, and then it just so happens, oh, we have all these level 4 labs here in the States, and
they're all over the place. And, yeah. And it's like, accidents,
Ukraine, yeah,
accidents happen and stuff, and it's just it's very reckless. And then I was reading the other day about China had been developing something with 100% kill rate in mice or something. Wow. It's just like, man, this is getting so out of control. But that's why, like, this book is so important, because it basically goes through the entire story and it tells you how the game is played, how it is hidden under benign covers. And I go from, it's funny because I actually have the first American president, George Washington, quoted on the deliberate use of smallpox as a biological weapon by the British. And people would find that hard to believe, but, you know, back then, that's what they would do. They would inoculate people with smallpox and then send them over to the Continental Army. And so I have a quote from George Washington in here, and that was really interesting. And then I go through, like, the years leading up to World War I, the British were carrying out attacks on America. So they were doing stuff like that. And they were also carrying out, like, these false flag attacks where they'd send disease. They would infect American horses that were going to Germany, or cattle, with foot and mouth disease. And then when I reached Germany, Germany thought that the Americans were doing that as an attack, when it was actually British intelligence doing that to pin Germany against America so that America would side with Britain. So it was very Machiavellian. But yeah. I go through a lot of that in the early chapters of my book. And so I go through, and then I go start going into, so the Spanish influenza thing, Russian intelligence thought that was a biological weapon by the British, and it may have been. I go through a lot of that, but it was that 1918 influenza that really got biological warfare programs rolling. Mm-hmm. And there was also a German sabotage campaign against America. It was a bioterrorism plot. They were going around infecting these horses with all these germs. But these horses were going to be used to turn out serums and vaccines. So they were intended to be like indirect attacks on humans. And I show how it plays into this whole Spanish influenza thing. It's very complex, but I lay it out in a good way. Then I kind of go into the Russian biological warfare programs, because they developed a very big program, even better than ours. And they had the best biological warfare program on Earth because they inherited the entire laboratory of Eric Traub. Like, they had his entire lab, and he was like the most skilled probably on Earth when it came to bioweapons.
Wow.
And they also got the Unit 731 from Japan. So they got the best of the best, and that's how they were able to kind of like take the lead. And they got really into this because it was something that you could do without much fancy equipment. So it was like really cheap to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And the Soviet Union didn't have much money. So they were like, okay, let's just concentrate all our time on this. And another thing about biological warfare is that, unlike chemical warfare and nuclear warfare, with biological warfare, you could say, hey, it was an act of nature.
Right.
We didn't do that, you know? So it was always this layer of plausible deniability that they could put on it and say, you know, what are you talking about? That was an act of nature, global warming, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was always a very, they like to attack in ways that are really hard to say, okay, that's an attack.
Yeah.
And that's why it was always, this war was always waged through intelligence channels, doing things like sabotage. And I talk about how there was also like a vaccine sabotage thing where they would infect, you know, they could infect the monkeys that were going to be used to make these vaccines with these stealth viruses. And that's actually happened. That actually is what happened with Marburg virus, the Ebola, the first version of Ebola, is that they were making polio vaccines. They were pressing up polio vaccines with these monkeys, and these monkeys had this hemorrhagic fever, Marburg, and they all started getting infected and caused that big outbreak. But it was like, if they hadn't gotten infected, they would have made those into vaccines, and the people who got them would have got infected.
Wow.
And so I show how that was also a big part of it. But it's, I don't know. I mean, I can say that there's probably no book like this right now. This book is just, I put so much into this. I'm so happy with the result, but it really, for the first time, lays out the entire life history of Eric Traub. And a lot of people, there's been an aura of mystery around him for a long time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you did a lot of research, and it's pretty awesome. Where's the best place for people to find your book?
So I would say Amazon. On okay. Amazon, you can find it. And also, I have a personal website for the book called thesleeperagent.com. And that's where my personal website for my book is. And I also have an area on that called videos where you can find my YouTube channel and my Rumble channel and my Odyssey channel. I don't know if I'll be on YouTube for much longer because it's like you mention something like vaccines and it's like automatically they're like, you know,
medical misinformation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. So I have to like almost speak in code when I talk about that stuff.
Yeah. It's because they care about it.
So I don't know how long that will be up. I mean, eventually they'll probably just start taking channels down, but, you know, I have the Rumble channel and the Odyssey channel. I probably will get BitChute at some point, but I haven't done it yet, but those are like the best places. And also my publisher is Trinday. You can also find the book there. And I've also seen it at like Barnes & Noble sites.
Oh, cool. Great. So it's getting out there. The information's getting out there. That's why I wanted to have you on. I have friends that have had Lyme disease, that currently have Lyme disease. And it's interesting how you mention basically how this disease basically harbors and attributes to other disease. Because I know a friend of mine that currently has Lyme disease and he's managing it, and he just continues to develop different ailments, like different types of arthritis. And then
a lot of times they had, you know, a lot of times people will get not just Lyme disease, but the whole cocktail of like Babesia, which is like a blood parasite, the rickettsia. So you can get like four or five infections in one bite. And that's another thing that I was able to link to him is these combined infections, because he was taught about it in 1939. And I'm able to show very reliably how this can be linked to Eric Traub for the first time.
They've been doing this for almost 100 years out in the open, you know, and now it's just finally coming to light.
Mm-hmm. And this book just, I mean, it really, it's eye-opening, the stuff that I found in here. I mean, researching this book, it was like, I could not believe some of the stuff I would find. And it's just like, wow, this is complete insanity.
But well, I'll put a link down below to your website. And really appreciate you coming on and talking about this. And any parting thoughts or parting words that you have for the listeners?
No, I mean, I'm getting the book out there. I'm doing as many appearances on podcasts as I can. I know I'm going to be, I think I've got an interview with on the David Knight show soon. And I've got somebody, so these, the film people that I was kind of advising, they're also very helpful to me. And it looks like I'm going to be getting a lot of attention for this at some point.
Excellent.
But for now, yeah, it's finally, after 6 years, it's so nice to see it and finished product. But yeah, I think I can say for people that this book will not disappoint.
Awesome. Awesome, Adam. Well, thanks for coming on.
Yeah. And
we appreciate the hard work that you put in, and it's good to hear that you're going to get paid for all that hard work. And y'all, this is a value for value proposition. So if you do love and appreciate the information that we're pushing out there, please go on over to thetexasboys.com and check out what we have over there, from our homestead to your house. It really helps, and it helps us do what we do. And we really appreciate Adam for coming on. And remember, y'all, stay fearless, my friends.